Okay, anyone seen this film? A few hands. Is it any good? A few nods, a few questionable shakes. Here's the key question. Did you feel sorry for Spidey while he was far from home? You did? Yeah, I mean, it's kind of the idea, isn't it? So like in this film, like in many kind of films, stories, books, it's a common kind of narrative tool that you take the lead character and you take them out of their comfort zone, you test them, you put them in an unfamiliar environment, and you inflict them with a whole load of challenges. You watch them endure it, you watch them navigate it, and at the end of it, you see them transformed into the person that we all would love to be, with their superpowers or special things that they've learnt. And so you end up leaving the cinema or your sofa kind of happy and feel like you've been on a journey with them. Now, the Bible has a few such characters, except that these are real people and real events in history. And their transformation isn't generally to greater abilities or to superpowers, but to greater faith in the God who led them through their challenges and to greater trust in his power. Now, I wonder if you can think of such people in the Bible. One that often comes to mind is Joseph. Joseph had a journey like that. Another is Daniel. And last week, we started a short series looking at his journey. So first, a little bit of context. Daniel is based in Babylon, a city in modern-day Iraq, and we're around 600 years BC. So the Babylonians have replaced the Assyrians as the dominant power across the region. Nebuchadnezzar has defeated the Egyptians and the Assyrians and taken over. Around the same time as Nebuchadnezzar became king, he also ransacked Jerusalem and carried off some of its brightest and best to Babylon, including a young man called Daniel. Now, Jerusalem has worse to come, and if you're in the group in the church currently reading through Jeremiah, you'll find out much more about that as you read through the book of Jeremiah. Our events today are introduced as happening in the second year of King Nebuchadnezzar's reign. So it's about 602 BC. Daniel and his friends have been in Babylon for a couple of years. And as we heard last week, they've become part of Nebuchadnezzar's counselors, his wise men. Okay, so you're all with me in terms of where we are. We're going to read chapter 2. Little warning, it's a very long passage. It's on page 838 of our church Bibles. So please turn up. That's page 838. And just as we do so, I'll summarize how the passage breaks up and how we're going to look at it. So page 838. Okay, it's in four parts. An angry king, a humble servant, the future revealed, and a response of praise. So that's how we're going to look at it. But there is also a key word in each of those first three sections, which I'm going to tell you now, so that when we read it, you can look out for it and see if you spot it. And it's the words and, but, and so. So look out for the key and, but, and so in the first three sections. Okay, section one, I'm going to read it now. It's Daniel 2, and we're reading from verse 1. In the second year of his reign, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. His mind was troubled, and he could not sleep. So the king summoned the magicians, enchanters, sorcerers, and astrologers to tell him what he had dreamed. When they came in and stood before the king, he said to them, "I have had a dream that troubles me, and I want to know what it means." Then the astrologers, that's all his wise men, answered the king, "May the king live forever. Tell your servants the dream, and we will interpret it." The king replied to the astrologers, "This is what I have firmly decided. If you do not tell me what my dream was and interpret it, I will have you cut into pieces and your houses turned into piles of rubble. But if you tell me the dream and explain it, you will receive from me gifts and rewards and great honor. So tell me the dream and interpret it for me." Once more they replied, "Let the king tell his servants the dream and we will interpret it." Then the king answered, I am certain that you are trying to gain time because you realize that this is what I have firmly decided. If you do not tell me the dream, there is only one penalty for you. You have conspired to tell me misleading and wicked things, hoping the situation will change. So then, tell me the dream, and I will know that you can interpret it for me. The astrologers answered the king, there is no one on earth who can do what the king asks. No king, however great and mighty, has ever asked such a thing of any magician or enchanter or astrologer. What the king asks is too difficult. No one can reveal it to the king except the gods, and they do not live among humans. This made the king so angry and furious that he ordered the execution of all the wise men of Babylon. So the decree was issued to put the wise men to death, and men were sent to look for Daniel and his friends to put them to death. Okay, let's pause there. An angry king. So Nebuchadnezzar is a new, young king. And on one level, he's experiencing what every or many new young kings might experience, which is fear. He's the emperor of an empire with all the anxiety complexes that might bring, whether about the security of his kingdom or the security of his own throne. But he's also having dreams. We don't yet know what the dream is about, but it has him seriously troubled. The same dream is coming night after night after night. He can't sleep, he's getting increasingly tired and increasingly angry. So you can imagine the atmosphere in court, that everyone is on edge as the king's temper begins to flare. Now, did you spot the key "and"? It comes a few times, verses 5 and 6. Nebuchadnezzar says, tell me the dream and interpret it. Nebuchadnezzar doesn't just want the dream interpreted, he wants the wise men to tell him what he dreamt. Now, is that fair? What do you think? Does that sound like a reasonable request? No. Okay. So like the wise men said in response, that's just not possible. In fact, the demand is repeated twice to emphasize how unreasonable it is. How unreasonable the punishment is for the fact they can't do it. But just think for a moment why Nebuchadnezzar says that. Now, some might think that interpreting a dream can sometimes be a little bit subjective. I don't know if anyone's ever asked you for an interpretation of their dream or if you've ever offered one. My guess is that if you're interpreting dreams for a king like Nebuchadnezzar, you might be a little bit tempted to tell him what he wants to hear. But Nebuchadnezzar knows that this dream is significant. It's a vision of something important. So just as the dream is from beyond the natural realm, he looks for an interpretation from beyond the natural realm. And to prove that's where the interpretation is from, rather than something made up in his wise men's minds, he demands a revelation of the dream from beyond the natural realm. He knows it's humanly impossible, but that's what he needs to be sure that the interpretation is reliable. The problem is that the wise men have no access to the gods. And so the writer prepares us for what comes next. So let's read on. This is from verse 14. This time you're looking out for the key "but". When Arioch, the commander of the king's guard, had gone out to put to death the wise men of Babylon, Daniel spoke to him with wisdom and tact. He asked the king's officer, why did the king issue such a harsh decree? Arioch then explained the matter to Daniel. At this, Daniel went into the king and asked for time, so that he might interpret the dream for him. Then Daniel returned to his house and explained the matter to his friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. He urged them to plead for mercy from the God of heaven concerning this mystery, so that he and his friends might not be executed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. During the night, the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a vision. Then Daniel praised the God of heaven and said, praise be to the name of God forever and ever. Wisdom and power are his. He changes times and seasons. He deposes kings and raises up others. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to the discerning. He reveals deep and hidden things. He knows what lies in darkness, and light dwells with him. I thank and praise you, God of my ancestors. You have given me wisdom and power. You have made known to me what we asked of you. You have made known to us the dream of the king. Then Daniel went to Arioch, whom the king had appointed to execute the wise men of Babylon, and said to him, "Do not execute the wise men of Babylon. Take me to the king, and I will interpret his dream for him." Arioch took Daniel to the king at once and said, "I have found a man among the exiles from Judah who can tell the king what his dream means." The king asked Daniel, also called Belteshazzar, "Are you able to tell me what I saw in my dream and interpret it?" Daniel replied, "No wise man, enchanter, magician, or diviner can explain to the king the mystery he has asked about. But there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries. He has shown King Nebuchadnezzar what will happen in days to come. Your dream and the visions that pass through your mind as you were lying in your bed are these." Okay, let's pause again. I realize that's on a cliffhanger. Now, just consider Daniel's actions in what we've just read. First, he speaks to the commander of the king's guard, a pretty senior and scary official. Daniel speaks with wisdom and tact. He then goes boldly and courageously to the king to ask for more time, knowing that the king is in an impetuous mood. He's being angry and rash. Daniel then gathers his team. Now, this is a key bit and picks up on what we heard last week from Simon. Daniel knows that they need God, so he comes to God in prayer, but he doesn't do it alone. He gets the team to pray, his three fellow Israelites who we met last week. Now, I think that just begs a question. It's an aside, but I think that begs a question of us, whether we do that. We have home groups, we've got prayer triplets, we've got WhatsApp groups, bands of brothers, and no doubt other groups that I don't know about. So often we do gather people together to pray. But how often do we battle alone in prayer as well, when actually we could gather the team to be praying with us? Faith is a team sport, and as we heard last week, we need to remember to use the team. And then when God answers his prayer, we see Daniel's response, which is one of praise. Daniel is the humble servant of the king and the humble servant of God. Now, it's interesting to note that some of what happens here in chapter 2 is probably only possible because of what has already happened that we read about in chapter 1. It appears that both Arioch and the king are willing to give Daniel some face time, showing their respect for him. And they also give him what he wants, which is an audience with the king or some time to seek his God. Nebuchadnezzar doesn't seem inclined to offer that to other people, but he does offer it to Daniel, which suggests that Daniel has earned his respect. And did you note how God answers Daniel, which is in another dream? Daniel is passive at that point. He's not searching for an answer. He's not inventing something in his mind and testing it with God. He's passive. And God places in his mind the dream of revelation. It is very clearly from God. Now we see David's humility in his song of praise in response. God has all wisdom and power over nature and over the rulers of earth, not Daniel or Nebuchadnezzar. God gives wisdom and insight into truth. He's the revealer of mysteries. It's a short prayer, but it's rich with honouring, exalting praise. Did you spot the but? Did you spot the but? It's there as the link between verses 27 and 28. Exactly. Daniel repeats what the wise men have already told the king, that what Nebuchadnezzar is asking is impossible. It's impossible. It can't be done. No one can reach into the king's mind to know what he has dreamt. But there is a God in heaven who can. Now, I would say this is the word on which this whole chapter rests, but. And in fact, it's really the word for the Christian in the face of all impossible situations. I have no hope but you. I have no power but you. I have no idea where I'm going but you. It's a word which in that context humbles ourselves and exalts our God. Yet it strikes me as funny that in our regular everyday use of the word but, it's often the opposite. Often we use it in a way which kind of precedes a self-justification. I know I did something wrong, but he hit me first, or I was hungry, or she deserved it, or I'd worked really hard. We justify ourselves with a but when we're challenged. We often defend ourselves with a but. Yet here in prayer, it's completely different. In prayer, we confront the challenges of our life and our own weaknesses with a humble and honest recognition of our limitations. We come powerless and messy, but we come to one who is all-powerful and merciful. The task set for Daniel was impossible, and his life and the lives of his friends depended on it. But there is a God in heaven, an all-knowing, all-powerful, and merciful God. Okay, we're actually going to take a short pause as we look through Daniel. We're going to pause there. We're going to sing a song together first, and then I'm going to come back for the second half of Daniel 2 in a few moments. Okay, so we've done the angry king and the humble servants. Now on to part 3. We're going to read on again. So if you've lost your page, it's on page 840. And we're going to pick up from verse 29. As your majesty, this is the dream now that Daniel is describing. As your majesty was lying there, your mind turned to things to come, and the revealer of mysteries showed you what is going to happen. As for me, this mystery has been revealed to me not because I have greater wisdom than anyone else alive, but so that your majesty may know the interpretation and that you may understand what went through your mind. Your majesty looked, and there before you stood a large statue, an enormous, dazzling statue, awesome in appearance. The head of the statue was made of pure gold, its chest and arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of baked clay. While you were watching, a rock was cut out, but not by human hands. It struck the statue on its feet of iron and clay and smashed them. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold were all broken to pieces and became like chaff on a threshing floor in the summer. The wind swept them away without leaving a trace. But the rock that struck the statue became a huge mountain and filled the whole earth. This was the dream, and now we will interpret it to the king. Your majesty, you are the king of kings. The God of heaven has given you dominion and power and might and glory. In your hands he has placed all mankind and the beasts of the field and the birds in the sky. Wherever they live, he has made you ruler over them all. You are that head of gold. After you, another kingdom will arise inferior to yours. Next, a third kingdom, one of bronze, will rule over the whole earth. Finally, there will be a fourth kingdom, strong as iron, for iron breaks and smashes everything. And as iron breaks things to pieces, so it will crush and break all the others. Just as you saw that the feet and toes were partly of baked clay and partly of iron, so this will be a divided kingdom. Yet it will have some of the strength of iron in it, even as you saw iron mixed with clay. As the toes were partly iron and partly clay, so this kingdom will be partly strong and partly brittle. And just as you saw the iron mixed with baked clay, so the people will be a mixture and will not remain united any more than iron mixes with clay. In the time of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that will never be destroyed, nor will it be left to another people. It will crush all those kingdoms and bring them to an end, but it will itself endure forever. This is the meaning of the vision of the rock cut out of a mountain, but not by human hands. A rock that broke the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold to pieces. The great God has shown the king what will take place in the future. The dream is true and its interpretation is trustworthy. Okay, let's pause again there. So the dream is revealed. The revealer of mysteries, God, gave the dream to the king, and he gave its meaning to Daniel. Did you spot the so? So it's there in verse 30 to explain what God is doing, and it links to verse 45 at the end. The purpose of the dream is so that the king might understand what would happen in the future. It's a prophetic vision. So what's it all about? Well, here is a rough picture of what Nebuchadnezzar might have seen according to Daniel's description. It's a statue in four parts: a head of gold, a chest of silver, a belly of bronze, legs of iron, and feet partly of iron and clay. Daniel explains that each part represents a different empire, but he doesn't say where those empires will come from or how long they'll last, which means people like to speculate. Now, probably the most common view is this one, with the head representing the Babylonians, the chest being the Persians who came next, the belly being the Greek Empire, and the legs the Romans. Now, some say the Roman Empire is also the divided feet. Others say the feet represent the time from the Romans onwards. And you see why people say this, as during the Roman Empire, Jesus then comes as a supernatural rock, which introduces a new kingdom, which over time fills the whole earth. Now, we know from Daniel that the first bit is right. Daniel says that the head is the Babylonian Empire. And I think we know that the last bit is right, in that the rock, which becomes a mountain, is God coming from heaven to set up a kingdom that will never be destroyed. But we do have to hold a little bit lightly the bit in the middle, which isn't explicitly explained to us. The key message is this: that all earthly kingdoms will come and they'll go, and only God's kingdom will last forever. Earthly kingdoms may look mighty, but they will each become like chaff on the threshing floor. Now, I suspect for most of us, the closest we ever get to a farm is if we walk along Hackney Road, and there isn't much chaff around there, as far as I'm aware. Now, my mum comes from an arable farming, so she would probably explain this better than me. But as I understand it, when you've harvested your crops, whether wheat or rice or whatever, chaff is the stuff left over when you've separated out the seed from the bit around it, the husk around it. The chaff is unwanted. It's light, it's insignificant, and the wind blows it away. Now, this is what the mighty Babylonian Empire will become, and all other empires. They are like chaff. As Daniel reminded us in his prayer of praise, God is in control. God deposes of kings and raises up others. God deposes kings and raises up others. At his appointed time, he will introduce his kingdom with dynamic power, which will be the deciding factor in all history. Isaiah writes, "In the last days, the mountain of the Lord's temple will be established as chief among the mountains. It will be raised above the hills, and all nations will stream to it." We'll come back in a moment just to consider why God gives that message now. But first, let's just see the response. So we're going to read from verse 46 to the end. "Then King Nebuchadnezzar fell prostrate before Daniel and paid him honor and ordered that an offering and incense be presented to him. The king said to Daniel, 'Surely your God is the God of gods and the Lord of kings and a revealer of mysteries, for you were able to reveal this mystery.' Then the king placed Daniel in a high position and lavished many gifts on him. He made him ruler over the entire province of Babylon and placed him in charge of all its wise men. Moreover, at Daniel's request, the king appointed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, the Those are the Babylonian names for Daniel's three friends. He appointed them chief ministers over the province of Babylon, while Daniel himself remained at the royal court. Okay, so the king offers Daniel expensive gifts like incense. He honors him and he promotes him. But more importantly, he acknowledges Daniel's God. Surely your God is the God of gods and the Lord of kings. It's a response of humble praise. But now to our key question. Why does God do this? What is going on in God's purposes? Why does he give this vision to a pagan king and its interpretation to Daniel? Well, to answer that, I think the place to start is to look at the outcomes. Nebuchadnezzar comes to acknowledge and praise God. That's a good thing. Who knows how long it's going to last? We'll read on through Daniel to discover that. But it's a good thing. Daniel and his friends get good positions in the Babylonian civil service. That's a good thing, both for them and for Babylon. Again, we don't know for how long. More significantly, Daniel and his friends and all the wise men are saved from death. God intervenes in his mercy and he saves them. That is a very good thing. It reminds us that our God is a God who intervenes and saves. But I think here that there are two bigger outcomes. And for this, I think it's important to recognize that Daniel is what you might call an episodic book. Now, what do I mean by calling Daniel an episodic book? Well, has anyone been watching this program on TV? Anyone seen it yet? It's a new David Mitchell BBC drama. I'd recommend it, but it depends on your taste. Okay, it's a 6-part drama where every episode stands alone. In each episode, there's a murder, a load of suspects, and a resolution. But then across the series, there's another mystery which ties the series together. Now, just like Ludwig and many other TV box sets, the first half of Daniel is episodic. It's a series of episodes where each chapter can stand alone as its own self-contained story with its own significance. But there's also a common purpose across the whole book. So what's the message of this episode? Well, it's the message of the vision and Daniel's prayer. God is bigger than even the most powerful of kings. He has purposes and plans across millennia. The kings of the earth will be appointed by him to reign and will be removed by him like chaff. His kingdom is the only kingdom which will last forever. Now, the Israelites are in Babylon and are exiles far from home. They are subject to a king, an evil, hostile king, a king who has captured their homeland and taken them out of it, a king who seems more powerful than any king they've ever known. So God reminds them that he, God, is bigger than even the most powerful of kings. He sets empires up and he will knock them down, even Babylon. He is always in control. God is the big but of history. It may look impossible, but God. Now, there's something for us in that too. Because wherever we're daunted, or wherever we might look around us and feel that evil earthly powers are ruling, whether they may be locally, in workplaces, or nationally in big global politics, we can be reminded too that God is always in control. God raises up and God will remove. So if that's the message of this episode, what about how it contributes to the purpose of the whole series? Well, we saw it last week, and we'll see it more in the weeks to come as well, but I would summarize it as this. that God is with his people. Even here in Babylon, far from home, far from the land God had given them, far from where he said he would dwell with them, God is with his people. God rescues Daniel and his friends from death. He gives a prophetic vision to a pagan king, and he gives an interpretation to Daniel. God is with his people. He is at work amongst his people. He's reminding Daniel and all the Israelites with him in Babylon that he is with them still, even here, far from home. Now that might seem obvious, but I think at the time that would have been a really encouraging and maybe a shocking message for the Israelites in Babylon. Because just remember why they're in Babylon. They were being punished by God. Over many, many generations, the Israelites had turned their backs on God and gone after a whole host of other gods. They'd ignored his directions and spurned him. So God had punished them. He'd sent them away. It's not surprising that by the rivers of Babylon they sat down and wept. They thought they were alone and abandoned by God. But he is with them still. His love for them goes on still. Even in Babylon, far from their spiritual home, where God had dwelt with them in Jerusalem, God is still with his people. He is still at work for his people. Now that's 2,600 years ago. What's the implication of that for us? We're not in Babylon. But the key parallel is that we're in exile too. That's why the book of Daniel, the whole book of Daniel, is so relevant to us. Now, some of us may be physically a long way from the place where we grew up, a place of birth, or a place that we might call home. But that's not what I mean. I mean that in a spiritual sense, if we're followers of Jesus, well, wherever we're from, our home is heaven, not earth. Our identity is with Christ. It's not defined by here. This is not our home. The Bible says really clearly that we are strangers here. So sometimes, quite naturally, like the Israelites in Babylon, we might feel that we've been left alone. We might feel far from God. We might feel that we are far from our true home. Particularly when it's been 2,000 years since Jesus walked on this earth. So to us, as to the Israelites, the message of Daniel is this, that when you feel that God is far away, know that he is with you still. If you've drifted far from God, he is with you still. When you question if you're being punished by God, know that he is with you still. If you're wondering how you can ever be right with God again, know that he is with you still. The problem with analogies is that they're often, usually, imperfect, particularly when we compare our parenting to God's, and I suspect most of us never get that right. But I remember one day as a child being told off by my dad. I remember being sent to my room, and I remember it particularly well because one of my favourite programmes was on, and as a result, I missed it. So I was being punished. But I also remember that my dad came and sat with me. He wanted to help me learn what I'd done wrong. And I remember it because he missed that program too. So God misses out. He didn't want Jerusalem and his temple destroyed. He didn't want to punish his people through the Babylonians. But in his mercy, he stayed with his people. And he is always with us still. So why do we have this strange story of an angry pagan king, a humble servant of God, and a dream revealing the future? Well, to remind us that the God we worship and praise is bigger than all the rulers of earth. He holds history in his hands, and only his kingdom will ultimately last. He is always in control. And to encourage us that, like the Israelites at the time of Daniel, we can be reminded that wherever we are, wherever we go, however far we may feel from God, that he is with us still. Our God is forever faithful. So may we stay faithful to him. Amen.